one, it's also good to set 2 cubits. If you guys want to get 2 cubits and set 2, do it now. But that's going to go up in price. At $99 off, you can see.
My students do get usually an 82 mean always on my test. That's perfect. And boy, they're pretty good tests. I mean, you've actually got questions from them, and those questions actually come from the tests that I give my students. Those are pretty good questions, and those are the ones they get out, and they usually get an 82 mean. That's pretty good. That means they're learning it. Good. I love it when they get A's. Unlike a lot of teachers, you know, oh, crap, I got 29 A's. I should make the test harder. That's an idiot. That's a person that should not be a teacher. Okay, that person should be hung up and gotten rid of because they're an adversary of the student. Okay, it's an adversarial thing. They want to screw you. They want to make it so hard because they're happy when you get F's. The mean was 60. I'm so happy. That is so stupid. I'm not popular in my school among the professors because when they say, hey, we had a test and the mean was 65, and I look at them, I said, okay, I can tell you why it's 65 according to the literature. One, that was too hard. Two, it was so poorly written, that's why they got 65. I said, unequivocally, it wasn't because the students were stupid. You just wrote a bad exam. Period. And they just look at me and they get so pissed. I tell them straightforward. I mean, they can't stand me. Because I'm always telling them, you really think that they're stupid, huh? No, you're the ones that have the problem. You didn't teach it right, or your questions are so screwed up and they got more than one answer, or they don't have an answer at all. Okay? I said, you're the problem, not the student. Whoa! You can see why I'm not popular. See, I've got tenure. I could give a hoot and holler what they say. Okay, a couple of them listen to me, and then I teach them how to write questions and stuff like that. And so they write fair questions, and then the students do better, and everyone's happy. Horrible thing. Here we got a normal heart, and on the left we got a hypertrophied heart, and on the right we have an hypertrophied heart, but for different reasons. If you look at this heart, you can see that it's thick. And hypertrophy. This is called concentric hypertrophy. Over here, we have a dilated and hypertrophied heart. Okay, dilated and hypertrophied heart. Here we have a concentrically hypertrophied heart. There's two different etiologies for these hypertrophies. And it involves work. Would you agree that it would require a lot of work to contract and push blood against an increased afterload, like a stenotic aortic valve, or let's say increased total peripheral resistance from hypertension, would that be an increase in afterload? Well, that's going to produce this kind of hypertrophy, okay? But what if you had a valvular problem or something like that, and you had excess volume of blood in your ventricle, like obviously occurred here, you had increased preload, isn't that going to also increase work too? Because Frank Starling mechanism is going to have to go into effect because you're stretching, you're increasing preload in there, and they have to work at increasing the force of contraction. That produces hypertrophy too. So the beauty of this is that whenever you see concentric hypertrophy, that's an afterload problem. Whenever you see dilatation and hypertrophy, that's a volume overload, a preload problem. Okay, so there's two types. Now let's do some heart sounds here since we got these two up here. You know what an S1 and an S2 heart sound is? I can't go through that. Okay. Just the basic, remember that things make noise when they close. And so in systole, who's closing? The mitral and tricuspid valve, so that's producing the S1 heart sound. Mitral, of course, would close before the tricuspid because of the higher pressures. And then the second heart sound, please, who's closing then? Aortic and pulmonic, and remember there is a variation with respiration there, and that's because as the diaphragms go down and increase the intrathoracic pressure, okay, blood is being sucked into the right side of the heart because of that, and that means the pulmonic valve is going to close later than the aortic valve. So P2, pulmonic component of the second heart sound, separates away from A2 on inspiration and then comes back on expiration. So the S, the second heart sound, has a variation with inspiration. The P2 separates away from A2 because there's more blood coming into the right side of the heart, and so the valve closes a little bit later. You did know that, I hope. Now, an S3 heart sound can be normal in someone maybe under 30 to 35 years of age, but then if it's over that, then it's usually pathologic. S3 would have to, since S1 is the beginning of systole, S2 is the beginning of diastole, then obviously S3 must be an early diastole. It is due to blood in diastole going into a chamber that's volume overloaded. So it'd be something like this. Here's a volume overloaded chamber. So when diastole was occurring, blood from the right, left atrium was going into this chamber that was already overfilled with blood. And it, when it went in there, it kind of made the turbulence in there, which makes a sound. That's called the S3 heart sound. So you only hear an S3 heart sound in a volume overloaded chamber. And it could be from the left ventricle's volume overloaded in left heart failure, for example, or in right heart failure, the right ventricle's overloaded, so you can have left-sided S3s, you can have right-sided S3 heart sound. It means volume overload in the chamber. It's kind of like, and some of you may not understand this this analogy I'm going to give you. In Washington, up northwest, you see a lot of rivers going into the ocean, the Pacific Ocean. And you all know that when rivers go into the ocean, it's great turbulence in that area, isn't there? Because you've got this one body of water emptying into a large body of water, a lot of turbulence. That's kind of like an S3 heart sound. Okay, the ocean is the ventricle with lots of fluid in it, and the river is the blood coming in diastole, and it hits this large mass of fluid, and there's turbulence there, S3 heart sound. Now, an S4 heart sound is in late diastole, and that's when the atrium is contracting to get that last bit of blood out into the ventricles. Here's the problem. You're going to get an S4 heart sound if you have a problem with compliance. Now, you should know what compliance is because you had PASO. Compliance, as you know, is a filling term. So when you talk about compliance, what's its ability to fill up? Well, would you all agree that if you had a ventricle this thick, that when that left atrium is contracting and trying to get blood into a ventricle that is that thick and is non-compliant, don't you think it's going to meet some resistance? Yes or no? And so that creates a vibration, and that produces the S4 heart sound. So an S4 heart sound is due to a problem with compliance. The left atrium is encountering some problem in putting that blood in late diastole into that ventricle. It doesn't want to fill up anymore. And that can be for two reasons. One, because it's so hypertrophied like this, or it could be because it's already filled up. And it has to put more blood into an already overfilled chamber. So either way, whether you have this kind of hypertrophy restricting filling up, or whether you have this kind of, where you have already a volume overloaded chamber and you're trying to put more blood in late diastole into it, you're going to get an S4 heart sound. So to summarize what I just said, I want to ask you this question. I want to talk about S4 and S3s and S4. Would a heart like this have an S3 heart sound? Is it volume overloaded? Yes or no? No. Okay, but would it have an S4? Yes. Okay, so if you had hypertension, which kind of heart would you have? This one or that one? This one. And so in hypertension, what abnormal heart sound should you have? S4. All right. Now let's look at this ventricle over here. Okay, will you have an S3 there? Absolutely. Why? Because it's got already volume overloaded. Would you also have an S4? Absolutely. Why? Because it can't fill up anymore. Analogy. My students had no problems with this. My second year is when I did this. Turkey dinner. Thanksgiving. You're all filled up, okay? So you're like this. Then the dessert comes out, okay? And it's, whoa, dessert. Do you have always room for dessert? Yeah. But you really got to really, really, you know, you're so full, but you still eat that apple pie, don't you? Okay, so you're able to fill it in there. It's kind of hard to put it into that stomach that's already filled up, but you fill it in there. There's a little vibration that occurs with that. And that's an S4 heart sound. So this patient would have an S3 and an S4 heart sound. So it'd be something like gallop rhythm. That's because they have S1, S2, S3, and S4. Got it? Okay. How do you know whether it's from the left or the right? That's really simple. It's breathing. Just I told you when you breathe in, right, you suck blood into the what side of the heart? Right side of the heart. So all right-sided heart murmurs and abnormal heart sounds, i.e. S3, S4, increase in intensity on inspiration if they're on the right side. And that's obvious. There's more blood in there. It just emphasizes those abnormal sounds. And you probably guessed it, on expiration, when you have positive intrathoracic pressures that are helping the left ventricle push blood out of the heart, abnormal heart sounds and abnormal murmurs increase in intensity on expiration. So all you have to do is say, oh, there's an S3 heart sound here, and I have to figure out which side it is. So, okay, could you take a deep breath? Ooh, it sounds a little loud. Okay, breathe out. Nope, not so loud. Breathe in again. Ooh, it's loud there. What side is it from? Right, there you go. That's it. Okay. So those are your... So I'm going to give you a couple scenarios. You say left, right, or middle. Ready? Okay. Essential hypertension. Left. Okay. Mitral regurgitation. Right. Mitral stenosis. Middle. I was just waiting. Okay. Okay, let's do murmurs. And then you'll understand why. Okay. This information, by the way, is in that first part in physical diagnosis. I'm going to do it now because we are getting into heart failure where we have to describe murmurs anyway. So now's the best time to do it. This is an original thought that I had. I've never read this thing. This came to me from somebody upstairs, obviously, because I could never have figured this out very honestly on my own. It dawned on me that stenosis means problem in opening the valve. Stenosis, problem in opening. Regurgitation or insufficiency means a problem in closing the valve. Cool. All right. That's going to help you to know that. It's because all you have to know is for stenosis murmurs, when the valve is opening, and that's when the murmur is going to occur. Okay. For regurgitation murmurs, all you have to know is when the valve is closing, that's when you're going to have the regurgitation murmur. So you ready? So let's deal with stenosis problems first. Okay. So, let's deal with, who is opening in systole? You tell me, come on. Aortic and pulmonic valves. So obviously the murmurs of aortic stenosis and pulmonic stenosis occur in systole. Okay, because that's when they're opening. And they're having to push blood through a narrow orifice. So just picture aortic stenosis. Left ventricle contracts, okay? It's encountering some great resistance. And you can hear that intensity of the murmur initially going up. As it's pushing, and it gets to a peak, and so what kind of configuration is that? Diamond-shaped configuration. That's why it's called an ejection murmur. So oftentimes on boards they have diagrams of the configurations of these things. And so an ejection murmur, like aortic stenosis, has crescendo, decrescendo appearance. Now all you got to know is where valves are heard best. You know, the aortic valve, right second intercostal space, pulmonic valve, second intercostal space, left, tricuspid valve, left parasternal border, apex mitral. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that's where the valve is. It's just that's where the noises are best heard, as you know. Okay, so in aortic stenosis, you have an ejection type of murmur in systole, heard best in the right second intercostal space, and where does it radiate? Into the carotids, and that murmur intensity increases on expiration. There you go. And you probably hear what abnormal heart sound? NS4. Very good. And pulmonic stenosis, forget it. You'd hear that mainly on the left side, okay? It'd be an ejection-type murmur. And again, it would increase on expiration as well. But that's rarest, hence to pulmonic stenosis. Now let's deal with diastole. Stenosis murmurs. Diastole. So who's opening in diastole? Mitral and tricuspid valves. So let's deal with mitral. Stenosis. Problem in opening it. Yeah, who's got the problem with mitral stenosis? The left atrium. Because here's the problem that this valve don't want to open. And it has to get it open to get blood in it. So obviously, it's going to get pretty strong because it has an afterload to deal with. So it gets dilated and hypertrophied. The atrium does. okay, which is, of course, going to predispose it to atrial fibrillation and stasis of blood and thrombus and all kinds of that kind. So you can picture this left atrium just dreading diastole, because it's going to have to get all this blood that's building up in it into the stinking ventricle in a millisecond. And so it goes, all of a sudden it snaps open. That's your opening snap. And then all that blood that was built up behind it comes gushing in. There's your mid-diastolic rumble. So you have an opening snap, followed by a rumbling sound as that excess blood that couldn't get in there earlier comes gushing into that left ventricle. Guys, if mitral stenosis is a problem in opening the valve, then you're underfilling the left ventricle. So there is no way in God's green earth you're going to have that or that. You're basically going to have no hypertrophy at all. A trick. That's a trick on the boards. No hypertrophy. You're underfilling it. He's having trouble getting blood into it, so it's certainly not having to work a whole lot, is it? The left atrium's having to do all the work. Of course, this murmur's going to be burst the best at the apex and will increase in intensity on expiration, mitral stenosis. Tricuspid stenosis, you can figure that one out too. Regurgitation. What's the definition? Problem in closing the valve. Okay, so let's deal with systole again. Nice and logical. Who's closing in systole? Mitral and tricuspid. Don't memorize those things, guys. Don't memorize them. Think about it. Okay? You certainly don't want the mitral or the aortic and pulmonic valve to close on systole, do you? You just defeat the purpose of life. Okay? Okay? So you want to make sure that that blood doesn't go whipping back into the atrium. So mitral and tricuspid valve are closing in systole. So if they're incompetent and they can't close properly, I want you to just picture this. Okay? Systole goes, boom. And then because the mitral valve can't close properly, let's say 80 mLs of blood, normal stroke volume, let's say 30 mLs goes whipping into the left atrium, and only, what, 50 mLs goes out the aorta. Okay, so what's going to happen then is that now there's even more blood in the left atrium than normal now. You just put 30 mLs of the stroke volume into it, plus it's already been trying to fill up, so you've got excess blood there, so you can see that there's way more blood going to be ending up in that ventricle. It gets volume overloaded, so it'll look like this. Okay? So how would the murmur characteristics be if it's a problem in closing the valve? It's certainly not going to be an ejection murmur. It's going to be just all the way through, as blood all the way through systole is going through that incompetent valve into the left atrium. So it's pansystolic or almost pansystolic. So it's more of a straight line effect. Not a crescendo, decrescendo. So it's straight across, sometimes obliterating S1 and S2. Okay, so again, apical murmur, pansystolic, S3 and S4 heart sound, because we have a problem with compliance as well as volume overload, increases in intensity on expiration. And then you can figure out the other side, tricuspid regurgitation. Pansystolic, okay, S3, S4 heart sound, left parasternal border, increases in intensity on inspiration. You know that was on a part one board, don't you? They talk about an IV drug abuser with fever. And this is how they described it, from what I heard from the student. Had a pansystolic murmur along the parasternal border, had an S3, S4 heart sound. They even said that there was accentuation of the neck veins in their thing. Okay, and they said, what is the most likely diagnosis in this patient? It was a febrile IV drug abuser. Okay? And, of course, they put down all kinds of things in there, but the answer was infected endocarditis of which valve? The tricuspid valve, which is the most common infection. So the whole thing rested very honestly in whether you knew that inspiration increases, that the murmur and heart sounds increase on inspiration, that's right-sided. Okay? Had the question been reworded and said that the murmur intensity increased on expiration, then it would have been infected endocarditis of the mitral valve. The whole thing rested on that. You didn't get that? Missed the question. Okay, so that's that one. Now let's talk about diastole. Who's closing in diastole? You hope that aortic and pulmonic valve is, so what you just pumped out doesn't come back in, right? See, I'm trying to think logically here, because I'm a logical, common sense person with 110 IQ. I'm not very smart. But I have some common sense, okay? All right? It might take me 10 times longer to learn something, but when Buddy gets it, Buddy's got it. Buddy doesn't need notes, if you noticed. What he doesn't, he knows. Why? I got it. And as I'm talking, I'm thinking about what it rather than memorizing it. I'm just going through logical things, plus the fact I do this 10 times a year, so any idiot should be able to do the same thing. It's just a minor point. But at any rate, all right, you got aortic regurgitation, let's say, like we saw with the syphilitic aneurysm. And that was due to stretching of the ring. Okay. So you can just picture this thing, okay? You have systole, whoop, and blood goes out. Okay, and then the valve should be closing properly, but it doesn't. And so some blood is going to be trickling back in. So let's say 80 cc's went out initially, and let's say 30 cc's of blood dripped back in. Okay, and so you can see that if blood is keeping on to dripping in at the beginning of diastole, you're going to get volume overloaded chamber. Then Frank and Starling are going to involve. The next thing you know, you got an end diastolic volume of 200 mLs as opposed to 120. And then you got that wah-oom thing, you know, with all that hyperdynamic stuff. So when would you hear the murmur then of aortic regurgitation? Right after the second heart sound. Because it's not closing and blood is dripping back in then. That makes a sound, a high-pitched diastolic blowy murmur right in second intercostal space, increases in intensity on expiration, S3 and S4 heart sound because it is a volume overloaded chamber, and it all increases in intensity on expiration, as we just said. Plus, you're going to have all those bounding pulses and all that stuff. Anybody know what murmur, what valve leaflet the dripping blood hits? Oh, come on now. The anterior leaflet of the mitral valve, guys. The anterior leaflet of the mitral valve actually is one side of the outflow tract out into the aorta. And so does anybody have any remote idea about what murmur that creates? The Austin Flint murmur. All of you learned about that. You all know that when you have aortic regurgitation and you hear an Austin Flint murmur, what does that mean? You call your cardiac surgeon because that's the time to remove the valve. Because if you have that murmur, then you are significantly dripping back in there. That valve has to be replaced. So that's a significant murmur to know, okay, because when it's present, you got to do some surgery on that person. Okay, that's it, guys. Very, very simple. Murmurs are very, very simple. Not hard. Just think of it logically. All right, having said all this crap, let us talk about heart failure. All right, let me see where you are. I'm going to point to this. You tell me left or right. Are you ready? Left or right heart failure. Come on. Left. Okay, this is a section through lung. Left or right? Left. Liver? Right. Okay. Now I'm going to say a word. Paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea. Left or right? Very good. Okay, you're right. You're correct. actually, you guys are pretty good. I'd say that 99% of the groups that I've talked about, and I mentioned paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea or pillar orthopnea, they vary between left, right, left, and then when I say what the answer is, then they agree with me. Okay, those that were wrong. Okay, so let's make sure we understand all this. So let's do left and right heart failure, and we'll explain all this stuff to you. You were right on all of these things. That was very good. Left heart failure is forward failure. Your left heart, your left ventricles failed for lots of different reasons. One, because it's having to push against an afterload, it fails. Or it's having to deal with an excess volume, it fails. Or you've had so many infarcts, the left ventricle no longer is muscle, it's fibrous tissue, so your contractility is reduced, you failed. There's lots of reasons why a left heart will fail, but it's a forward failure because you're having problems in getting blood outside of it. So that means then that your end diastolic volume is going to increase because you can't get all the blood out, because you can't push it out. Man, that pressure and volume is going to go back into the left atrium and then back into the pulmonary vessels, increase the hydrostatic pressure, voila, pulmonary edema. Okay, and if it's, you have chronic left heart failure, then you actually have some hemorrhage and alveolar macrophages will phagocytose the red blood cells, and you'll have this rusty colored sputum, and when you do cytology, you see heart failure cells. Those are alveolar macrophages that have phagocytosed red blood cells, and it's broken down into hemosiderin. That's what this is right here. This is pulmonary edema. That's always left heart failure, not right heart failure. There's no way in God's green earth that right heart failure can produce pulmonary edema. No way. No way. And so, of course, I've read that left heart failure is a diagnosis of symptoms, because the main symptom of left heart failure, as you know, is dyspnea. Doctor, I'm having trouble breathing, and I can see why. Got fluid in there. Okay? And they say that right heart failure is a diagnosis of signs, not so much symptoms. So think about it. What's right heart failure? That's a problem in the right heart getting blood through the pulmonary vessels to the left heart. So if it fails, then blood builds up behind it. So it's a backward failure. Okay? Because if it can't get the blood through the pulmonary vessels into the heart, then blood will build up behind it. And so the hydrostatic pressures will increase in the venous circuit. So you get neck vein distension. And I made a big point, because I knew what was coming to this point in the lecture, that you're going to get hepatomegaly, that's painful, and you're going to have the so-called nutmeg liver. Because the increased pressures in the vena cava are going to be transmitted into the hepatic vein, which empties into it, and back into the liver to the central vein, and you're going to get these little red dots all around that looks like a nutmeg, a nut cut in cross-section. The most common cause of a congestive hepatomegaly, that's the correct term for this, is right heart failure. And of course, the increase in hydrostatic pressures are also going to produce pinning edema, possibility even of ascites with it. So it's more signs, isn't it, than it is symptoms. So neck vein distension, hepatomegaly due to this, pinning edema, ascites, all right heart failure. So when you lie down and go to sleep, what happens? Well, you can resorb up to about a liter of fluid from the interstitium will go into your venous side of your circulation, because there's no effective gravity anymore. And so you got a little bit of extra blood going back to the right heart and then into the left heart. But what if you have left heart failure? Okay, you have all this excess blood that wasn't there when you were standing up. It's now coming back, and this left heart's having a big-time problem to get it out, and then you've got more coming in. It says, I can't handle it. Go back. It does. It goes back into the lungs, and you get up. Window goes up. And 30 minutes, that's paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea. And eventually it settles down. You go to sleep, and the same stinking thing happens again. Then it dawns on you that when I stood up, it eventually went away, so maybe if I put a pillow under my head, maybe it won't come back. And that's called pillow orthopnea. That's why you quantitate it. Because if it's one pillow orthopnea, that means it's not too bad. But if you have to sit up, okay, you've got serious left heart failure, okay, because you're imposing gravity. Just putting your head on one pillow decreases venous return to the right side of your heart. You put two pillows up, that decreases it even more because there's more effective gravity. You sit up, it increases it even more. So pillow orthopnea and paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea are signs of left heart failure, not right. Okay? Now I put in there the concepts of systolic dysfunction and diastolic dysfunction. That is not part one. That's for part two. But I left it in there for those that are going to take part two. There you have to know it. Okay, the ejection fraction is what decides which type of disease you have. I'm not going to even discuss it now. That's part two. But I did put it in the notes for those of you that will be taking part two. And so, like I told you, these notes are excellent for part two. Why? Because it's the same notes I use except for a few things in there when I taught part two. Okay, and it worked. By the way, I talked to three people that took the course recently, and here were their scores for part one. One was 92. Another one was 94, and a third was 97. Okay? 92, 94, 97. The three people that I taught back just the last board review. One was in New York, and a couple were here. That's a pretty good score, don't you think? What do you think? Is that good? Yeah, I think that's good. I really do. I just love it when it works out like that. If you don't believe me, I'll have them come in here because they are over there in the study thing looking, we're preparing for part two, and they'll tell you. Okay. All right. That's heart failure. No. We've got to do one thing. Okay. If you have heart failure, left or right, what's the best non-pharmacologic treatment? Restrict water, restrict salt. All right. Good. You got that one down. Now, what is the king of the treatment of heart failure? It's the key because it decreases afterload and decreases preload at the same time. Angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitor. By using an ACE inhibitor, you increase longevity. Okay, why? Because you decrease preload, because there's decrease in aldosterone, so there's decreased salt and water reabsorption, that decreases preload. And by blocking angiotensin II, you decrease its vasoconstrictive effect on the peripheral resistance arterioles, so you're decreasing afterload. Now, all of you know about 6 months to 8 months ago, there was a big article that dealt with an amazing discovery, and that was is that people that were put on an ACE inhibitor and spironolactone did better than those who were done on an ACE inhibitor alone. And the reason for that was is that you eventually, aldosterone breaks through and eventually is elevated again, even though you're on an ACE inhibitor. So it's not a permanent suppression. And so they found out that by giving spironolactone, which specifically blocks aldosterone, plus the ACE inhibitor, there was an incredible, incredible increase in prognosis there. They actually had to stop the study. So now it is normal treatment to put a patient with heart failure on an ACE inhibitor and spironolactone because of the increase in longevity related to that. Okay, that's enough on that. High output failure. Well, you already know one cause of high output failure, and that was endotoxic shock. Remember that peripheral resistance arterioles were dilated from C3A, C5A, nitric oxide, remember all that crap? So there was increased venous return to the heart and all that stuff, and eventually it gives up. But there's many other causes, and a lot of them do relate to Poiseuille's law, viscosity over radius to the fourth power. And so if you vasodilate the peripheral resistance arterioles, okay, then you decrease total peripheral resistance, then more blood comes back to the right heart, left heart has to deal with it, you have to run the risk of high output failure. So you know one cause of that vasal dilatation was septic shock. Another one, thiamin deficiency. Now some of you may not be able to put that together, but actually you should be able to. What did I say was the problem in thiamin deficiency? ATP depletion, you recall? Recall? Don't you think the smooth muscle cells and the peripheral resistance arterioles need ATP? Yes or no? And so if you don't have a whole lot of ATP, do you think they work as well? No. Do you think maybe you get vasodilatation of the peripheral resistance arterioles then? You're going to get high output failure? Yes. So thiamin deficiency can produce high output failure because of vasodilatation of those vessels. Okay? Graves' disease, hyperthyroidism, because of the fact that thyroid hormone increases synthesis of beta receptors in the heart, okay, and you get an increase in force of contraction, there's more blood, the systolic pressures are higher, you go into high output failure with that. Okay, arterial venous fistulas. If I got stabbed in the leg at one time, over here, let's say, and I developed an arterial venous malformation, where I have arterial blood bypassing my microcirculation, going directly into my venous circulation, wouldn't the blood be coming back faster to my heart than normal? Wouldn't I have a bruit over that mass? Wouldn't it be pulsatile? Wouldn't it be that if I pressed the proximal portion of it, my heart rate would slow? Branham sign. Would it not? All of those are signs of an arterial venous fistula. Okay, that can do it too. So that's pretty much it for high output failure. Now my favorite subject of all, congenital heart disease. It's not your favorite, but it's my favorite. Why? Because you get confused by it. Don't. It's very easy. Not hard. First thing I warn you, better know your fetal circulation. Big time cold. Better know which vessels have the least amount of oxygen, which ones have the most. Remember, the baby's not exchanging blood with oxygen in the lungs. As a matter of fact, the pulmonary vessels in the fetus look like they have pulmonary hypertension. They are so thick, okay, that it's extremely hard to get blood through the pulmonary artery into the left ventricle. In fact, very little blood can go there. That's why you need a patent ductus in order to get it out of there. Okay, so where is all the oxygen coming from? It's coming from the chorionic villus dipping into this lake of blood which derives from mommy's spiral arterioles. And you got these chorionic villi just dipping into this blood, okay, and extracting oxygen from it. Now, obviously, this is not as good an oxygen source as the lungs, is it? Not really. And so you want a high affinity hemoglobin to be able to get what little oxygen's down in that area, and that's why God chose hemoglobin F for a fetus. Because if it's high affinity, it can grab that oxygen out of the blood. Okay. Now, the bad news is it gets it, and it doesn't want to give it up because that shifts the curve. It's kind of like a kid, isn't it? They get something. Mine, 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 mine. That's the favorite word of a kid. Mine. That's hemoglobin F. Mine. It's my oxygen. Okay? So how does God get around that? Well, it produces tissue hypoxia, so erythropoietin is released, and so the kid has an 18-gram hemoglobin. You all know that newborns have, in a sense, polycythemia because of that. So that's the way around that, the fact that hemoglobin F has a high affinity, gets around it by just making more RBCs, okay, with more hemoglobin in it, and the baby gets enough oxygen that way, as you know. So the blood goes through, and this is the order it goes through. The oxygen goes through the syncytial trophoblast of the chorionic villus, then the cytotrophoblast, then goes through the myxomatous stroma of the chorionic villus, and then it goes into the blood vessel. The blood vessel of the chorionic villi all coalesce to form the umbilical vein, only one. So that has the highest oxygen content. Okay, it goes up into the area of the liver, and has two ways it can go. One, it can go right into the hepatic sinusoids, and then it recollects into the hepatic vein and gets dumped into the inferior vena cava, or it can select the ductus venosus and just go straight across and go right into the inferior vena cava. Okay? Then it goes up into the right side of the heart. Now picture this. Picture this. The foramen ovale is open in all fetuses. Okay? It's not closed. Thank God. And so here's all this blood coming up. Okay? It's inferior vena cava now. It's coming up. And which direction do you think it's going to take? Do you think it's going to go pretty much straight across and go right through the foramen ovale, right into the left atrium? Or do you think it's going to go into the inferior vena cava, into the right atrium, down through the tricuspid valve, into the right ventricle? Which direction do you think? A is correct. It goes through the foramen ovale. So here's all this oxygenated blood goes directly from the right atrium, directly through the patent of foramen ovale, into the left atrium, left ventricle, and out the aorta. What about superior vena cava blood, though? Now, just picture, you know how that's coming in, right at the superior part of the right atrium. So what's coming down? Do you honestly think it's going to make an abrupt left-hand turn? It goes through and goes, and it goes through the foramen ovale? I don't think so. It's going to come in like that and go straight down through the tricuspid valve, right into the right ventricle. Okay. Now what's going to happen? It's going to go out the pulmonary artery. Problem! Problem! What's the problem? The pulmonary vessels are too thick. It's just tremendous, tremendous pressure against it. So what did God put in there to get the blood out of the pulmonary artery and back into the air? What did he do? He kept the patent ductus there. And how is it kept open? PGE2, made by the placenta as a vasodilator. And so you're getting, in a sense, a right-to-left shunt. That's how the blood can get out of the pulmonary artery and get dumped back into the aorta. Isn't that cool? Then when that baby's born and takes that first breath, there is a literal miracle that occurs. Maybe you don't believe in miracles. I do. Because I had Lou Gehrig's disease at one time. Okay? Diagnosed. That's amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. Does it look like I have it now? That was 10 years ago. No. And so I've been healed. Okay? So I believe in miracles because it happened to me. And I've seen many others. But I'll tell you this, here's another miracle, birth. When that baby breathes, those pulmonary vessels that look like they were all shut like that, open in a millisecond. And so all of a sudden, blood is going through those pulmonary arteries, and there's gas exchange occurring in the lung in literally seconds. That's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. These were thickened pulmonary vessels. And just, suddenly they're just open, they're wide open, and blood's going through them. Just because the oxygen levels went up in the baby. Amazing. Not only that, the patent ductus begins functionally closing and eventually closes and forms the ligamentum arteriosum. Got it? It's normal fetal circulation. So how many, by the way, when blood goes out the aorta, it goes into two umbilical arteries. Okay, so you have two umbilical arteries and one umbilical vein. So the vessels with the least amount of oxygen are the umbilical arteries. The one with the most oxygen is the umbilical vein. Okay? Now we're ready for congenital heart disease. Here we go. Now the way they do it on boards, guys, is oxygen saturations. Why? Because that's the way they diagnose them. They catheterize, and they measure pressures, and oxygen saturations in different chambers, and then they know which direction shunts are going. So that's the way they do it on boards. Now, don't worry. This is not hard. It's very simple. You have to get used to two terms, okay? I always screw this up. I always screw up the names that we use for these things in terms of oxygen. Kind of a step. There it is. It's step up and step down. Wipe on, wipe off. Wipe on, wipe off. Step up, step down. Step up, step down. What are you talking about, Dr. Boyan? I'm talking about that if you have a left to right shunt and you have oxygenated blood going into unoxygenated blood, what's happening to the oxygen saturation on that right side? Step up, because you're mixing oxygenated with unoxygenated blood. But what if you have a right to left shunt with unoxygenated blood going into oxygenated, what's going to happen to the step down? Very good. Step up, step down. Got it? All right. The oxygen saturation on the right side of the heart returning from the body is at 75%. The oxygen saturation on the left side is 95%. You ready? Let's do the most common one, ventricular septal defect, this one. I even hate to mention this, but I didn't know that normally there's just a membrane. Way back I didn't know now. I mean, I know now. But normally it's just a membrane in this portion of the septum. Did you know that? It's not just all muscle going straight up to there, and there's just a defect. No, no, no. There's normally just a membrane that has no hole in it that's there. So there is normally a membranous portion of your septum. I want to show you something. Notice the close relationship of that aortic valve leaflet and that septum. Please remember that. Okay, now, so I'm going to ask you a question. Who's stronger, the left ventricle or the right? Left. So which direction is the shunt going to go? Left to right. Okay, so oxygenated blood goes through here, gets dumped into the right ventricle. What happens there? Step up. Okay, also, it's going to pump it out into the pulmonary artery. So what about the pulmonary artery? Step up. So you have a step up of oxygen in the right ventricle and pulmonary artery. That's it. Okay, but let's continue the story. What if this was not corrected? Well, would you all agree that you're volume overloading the right side of the heart by all this blood coming over? Yes or no? The outcome of that will be pulmonary hypertension over time. Mainly because the pulmonary artery is having to deal with more blood, it's having to contract around it, you get pulmonary hypertension. Well, once you get pulmonary hypertension, then the right ventricle is having a problem contracting against that, so it gets hypertrophied. Suddenly, you run the risk of reversing the shunt, because then the right ventricle could become stronger than the left. And so, right ventricle is going to get a right-to-left shunt. But that has to have a name, doesn't it? What's that called? Eisenmenger syndrome. Very good. So an uncorrected left-to-right shunt has the potential for producing what? Eisenmenger syndrome, where you reverse the shunt, now you have cyanosis. Some people call it cyanosis tardive. That's another name. Okay? Most VSDs close spontaneously. Some need to be patched. We're done with that. Atrial septal defect. Now remember, it's normal for a fetus to have a patent foramen ovale. It is not normal once they're born. Okay, I'm going to ask you a question. Which direction is the blood going to go through this patent ductus? I mean, to this foramen ovale. Left to right, because the left side is always stronger than the right. So what's going to happen at the right atrium? Step up. So it's going to go from 75 maybe to 80%. What's going to happen in the right ventricle? Step up. What's going to happen in pulmonary artery? Step up. So what's the main difference between oxygen saturations in a VSD versus an ASD? There's a step up of oxygen also in the right atrium. Good. Okay. Now, are you volume overloading the right side of the heart? Yep. So do you run a risk for Eisenmenger syndrome? Yes. You know, and you also run a risk for something else, paradoxical embolization. What if you weren't lucky enough to have a deep venous thrombosis in your leg? And it embolized up and the pressures in the right side of your heart are increasing and you unfortunately have a patent foramen ovale. Do you think maybe that embolus can go into that right atrium, go right into your left atrium, and all of a sudden you have a venous clot in your arterial circulation? Didn't you ever wonder how it was possible for that to occur? It has to be a patient with an atrial septal defect. Does anyone know what the most common teratogen producing disease most commonly has atrial septal defect associated with it. Anybody want to hazard a guess what that is? Fetal alcohol syndrome. 2 out of 1,000 kids have fetal alcohol syndrome, and the congenital defect in the heart that's most common is atrial septal defect. We're done with this. Let's do the next one. Let's do a patent ductus arteriosus. Okay, is that normal? Is that normal in a fetus? But is it normal in once they're born? No. All right, so let's look at it. We got this connection between the aorta and the pulmonary artery. Who's stronger, the aortic pressures or pulmonic? Aortic, ooh. So that means unoxygenated blood goes from left and gets dumped into the pulmonary artery before it goes into the lungs. Is that correct? So what happens in the pulmonary artery? Step up. So now it's 80%. Anything else? That's it. That's the only thing that has a step up of oxygen in is the pulmonary artery. Because then it's going to go into the lungs, and the pulmonary vein should have the usual 95%. So that's the only thing you see in the patent ductus. And I think you can see, since there's an opening between these, you can see that blood swishing back and forth through systole and diastole. What do they call that murmur? Machinery murmur. Very good. And where do you think you're going to hear it? Where do you think you're going to hear it? Between your shoulder blades. What do you think this part of the aorta is? Here? I don't think so. Back there. Machinery murmur. Okay. Now, do you think maybe you can volume overload the right side of the heart again with this left to right shunt? Yeah? You get pulmonary hypertension? Yeah. Now which way will the shunt go? Well, the way it went when they were a fetus. Right? You're going to have unoxygenated blood going this way and dumping into the aorta. Now watch. Where does the ductus empty? Distal to the subclavian artery. So this baby's going to have, is going to be pink on top and blue on the bottom because you're dumping unoxygenated blood below the subclavian artery. So they have what's called differential cyanosis. Cyanotic on top, pink on top, cyanotic on the bottom because you're dumping it below. Okay. Anybody know the teratogen associated with patent ductus? Congenital rubella. Now, if you had a patent ductus and you knew there were no other defects in the heart that depended on it, okay, could you close it off without surgery? How are you going to do it? Indomethacin. How does that work? Well, it's a potent nonsteroidal which would inhibit PGE2, and therefore it would start constricting and will close usually on its own. Got it? Good. Next congenital heart disease. Tetralogy of Fallot, the most common cyanotic congenital heart disease. What's tetra mean? Four. And so we have an overriding aorta. What does that mean? It means it's kind of straddling the septum. Isn't that most of our lives? We kind of walk on two sides. Straddle, sometimes we're good, sometimes we're bad, kind of thing. Well, whatever, that's the least important thing. We have a septal defect. Membranous septal defect. We have, not at the level of the valve, cusps, we have a valvular pulmonic stenosis below the valve. So I'm showing stenosis here, and we get right ventricular hypertrophy. So that's the tetra, that's the four parts. Now listen careful, here's your board question. What determines whether you develop cyanosis or not? Well, the answer to that question is the degree of pulmonic stenosis that you have. Not all babies with tetralogy of Fallot have cyanosis. They're called acyanotic tetralogy. Why would that be? Let's think about that. What if the degree of pulmonic stenosis wasn't all that bad? Well, then that means when that right ventricle contracts, wouldn't a lot of blood go up the pulmonary artery and get oxygenated, and much less blood would go and get dumped into the left ventricle, agreed? So they would probably not have cyanosis at birth. But what if it was a very, very severe stenosis? And when the right ventricle contracts, very little got up there, so most of it would be shunted from right to left. So what happens in the left ventricle in terms of oxygen? Is it a step up or is it a step down? Yeah, you go from 95 to maybe 80%. And you're going to be cyanotic now. So the moral of the story is it's the degree of pulmonic stenosis that determines whether you have cyanosis or not. That's a board concept big time. Now, there was a very tricky question that me, moi, had to look up because I didn't know the answer. I thought I had an idea, but I like to see it in print. There was a board question that said, which of the following groups of shunts is cardioprotective in a patient with tetralogia for low? And they had all these different shunts in there and all that stuff. The answer was patent ductus, arteriosus, and atrial septal defect. Now, let's see if we can understand why that would be good in tetralogia for low. Okay, so let's say I wish we had both of these things in this diagram, but we don't. But let's make believe. Can we make believe? Let's make believe that we have an atrial septal defect. Okay, so which way would blood go there? Left to right. So in other words, we get oxygenated blood emptying into the right atrium. What would it do in the right atrium? Step up oxygen. That's good, isn't it? Because if it's stepped up there, it's stepped up here. Okay, so that means that when blood goes from here into here, there's at least a little bit more oxygen in it than before. So that's good. We want that. Now, how about a patent ductus arteriosus? Let's make believe that we have a patent ductus over here. Okay, that's a communication. So we have this unoxygenated blood going this way, but we can push it from left down, left from the aorta down into the pulmonary artery to get oxygenated. Okay, so we can take some of that unoxygenated blood and put it back into the pulmonary artery where it gets oxygenated, comes into the pulmonary vein, is 95%, and so we get more out. So it's good to have a patent ductus, and it's good to have a patent foramen ovale if you have tetralogy FLO. That's the moral of the story. By the way, what kind of abnormalities are you going to get with right-to-left shunting? Polycythemia, right? What else? A real risk for infective endocarditis. Okay, real risk for infective endocarditis. Why? Because you got these shunts. You got a shunt from the right side going right into your systemic circulation. Not good. Not good. Okay, so that means you can get vegetation spreading to your brain, multiple cerebral abscesses, anywhere it wants. Not good. All congenital heart diseases are at risk for infective endocarditis. Oh, God, did I forget to set this thing? I'm sorry. So I'll give you the full time. Okay, it's break. So I got to, okay, gotcha.